It's only been a week since I've been gone, less than really. And I already miss you, so I love being back with you in this way. This week, I visited an apartment with my friend Eric, who is a master craftsman and woodworker. He is also trained in design, art, and architecture. Early on in our visit, we stepped into a still unfinished bathroom, and Eric said as he looked into a white bathtub, "Do you see the nearly 20 shades of gray at play in this light?" I was dumbfounded. All I saw was white. Not off-white, not flat white, not eggshell white, just plain old white. No gray anywhere. After years of practicing his craft, working with interior designers, and his own 30-plus years of Buddhist meditation, Eric has learned to be attentive and to truly see and understand color in a way that I cannot. My experience with Eric confirms something that I fervently believe. It takes real work to see the world as it is. Few of us do. Instead, we see the world through the very particular lenses we carry with us, lenses shaped by cultures, traditions, educations, and biases. I think we recognize this truth now, perhaps more than ever before. For example, you can unearth your racial biases quite easily by taking online tests, such as the one offered by Project Implicit at Harvard, that show you rapid-fire images of persons with different racial traits, and then measuring our felt responses to those images. Pretty quickly, we can receive unwelcome confirmation that we are nowhere near as race neutral as we would like to believe. Our capacity to see the world is not just distorted by macro issues like racial bias. Our vision is also disfigured by the wounds and traumas we've suffered in childhood. Early slights and assaults, experienced when we were so delicate and new to the world, continue to shape us. So, for example, those who have suffered any form of early abandonment are often absolutely convinced that our closest friends and even our partners are only moments away from abandoning us. And others of us who grew up in angry households and so felt a lot of anger are hair trigger ready to believe that just about everyone is mad at us. And those of us who went unseen continue to feel invisible. We see the world and ourselves as we have been conditioned to interpret them. Now, this does not mean that the world is unknowable or that we all live in different worlds, although it sure does feel like that in our politically polarized times. The real world is stubbornly and beautifully present. That's why when we walk around in the world in the grip of distorted interpretations, things go very wrong. Our misinterpretations and blind spots lead to real hurt for ourselves and for others. Distorted vision inflicts enormous costs. Just as a distracted person obsessed with their phone is more likely to walk squarely into a utility pole, the world insists itself upon us. The utility pole doesn't care that you didn't see it. And your nose will feel the impact of what you did not see. It doesn't matter if you don't believe in global warming when wildfires force you to flee your home in desperation, as so many were tragically forced to do in Maui. As entire towns are evacuated in Canada, as unprecedented flooding afflicts parts of Michigan or New York, We are slowly realizing that what you can't or refuse to see really can hurt you. So then we face a desperately urgent question, a question we don't even realize must be asked. How can we learn to see the world clearly? It seems that just opening our eyes won't do the trick. Obstacles to clear vision seem infinite. It isn't just that we see the world through the distorted lenses of cultural bias and family history. We are also actively being taught to see the world wrongly. These carefully crafted lessons in distorted vision come at us hard and fast, and not in flat-footed messages, but in skillfully packaged advertising and through the brutal necessities of life in capitalist times. Consider messages like these, which bombard us daily. You are only worth what you can make. You are worth only what you can afford to buy. When you live in a society that forces most of its citizens to live from paycheck to paycheck, or makes it nearly impossible to pay rent or mortgage if you fall ill at work, if you live in a society with no guaranteed paid vacations, it is hard to ignore the message, you are only what you do. Your work is the single most important component about your identity. No wonder then that the first question most of us ask when we meet strangers at parties is, what do you do? There are powerful, almost irresistible forces at work teaching us to misinterpret the world, ourselves, and others in grossly compromised and compromising ways. Now, some of you may well be wondering, what does this have to do with our lectionary readings? Or even worse, you might be thinking, John's a real downer. New York seems to be taking quite a toll on him already. Where's the gospel in this? Where's the good news? Fair questions indeed. St. Paul has this very question in mind. How do we truly see the world as it is? When he tells us, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds so that you can discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Paul understands something we don't. It's no easy thing to discern what is the will of God, or even to see beyond the tip of our noses, so that we can sort out what is in fact good and acceptable and perfect. Only renewed minds lead to clarity of vision. When you are miseducated and corrupted by a world that tells you that honor and status are priceless commodities, and that's the Roman world Paul lived in, it's ludicrous to worship an executed working-class Jew of no account, let alone one put to shame on the cross. Paul knew all too well about how the world of his time distorted and corrupted the mind into conformity. And Paul knows how radically countercultural his gospel is when he says in 1 Corinthians, when I came to you, brothers and sisters, I did not come proclaiming the testimony of God to you with superior speech or wisdom, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. To counter the distortions of an honor-shame culture and its miseducation, a miseducation that despises the poor, the criminalized, the other, the stranger, Paul urged his listeners to fix their eyes on the crucified Messiah. In his time and ours, nothing could be more countercultural. Really? An executed criminal is the key to seeing reality clearly? And then he urges Christian communities to live in the way of the crucified Messiah. He urges Jesus' followers to refuse and honor culture's impulse to always compare your status with others. He urges his readers to resist the temptation of hierarchy, which urges us to see ourselves as better than the next guy in some way. Our class status, the size of our bank account, our educational attainments, or our good looks. This happens to be my temptation. Paul urges us to discard that baggage and instead writes, "I say to everyone among you not to think of yourselves more highly than you ought to think." Astonishingly radical and deceptively simple. Few practices distort our capacity to see each other as we really are, as beautiful and beloved children of God, than this impulse to see ourselves as better than others, or I should add, as worse than others. That toxic game wildly disfigures vision. Tragically, the first victim of this habit is oneself. Think what it means that you and I so often need to see ourselves as better than others in order to believe that we are worthy or valuable. It's a heartbreaking act of self-violation if I can only feel good about myself by demeaning you. So how do we overcome this temptation? Paul urges us to practice the work of becoming a loving community. Recognize the gifts of others and of yourself. Each and every gift matters. Maybe you have the gift of teaching, or the gift of music, or the gift of encouraging people when they get down. Each gift matters. They are all precious and given by God, who believes that you are precious, that you matter, that you are beloved. And don't you go ranking gifts. That too is a way to conform to the worldly game of hierarchy. It's no offense to anyone but your own ego to see yourself clearly as no better and no worse than anyone else, because all are of infinite worth in God's eyes. Now, if that's what it means to see ourselves and others clearly, then it's going to take some practice, some concrete discipline. And Paul is laying it out. He wants us to practice this way of being with each other in our common life. The great gift of practicing a lateral rather than a hierarchical life of loving communion is that then we acquire the capacity to see each other and ourselves clearly. Seeing clearly takes practice. It requires work. When we learn to live as a community of equals who love each other and celebrate each other's equally precious gifts, we will become transformed by the renewal of our minds. Concretely, getting to brass tacks, this means that our life together as a church matters. Our putting up with each other, our seeing each other, and loving each other is spiritual practice. Spiritual practice is not just confined to what we do in solitude in our meditation cushion. I mean, just learning to put up with me. Now that's real spiritual practice. And if you don't believe me, just ask my wife. A final word. It is extraordinarily difficult to know what it means to see the world clearly without a clear-sighted role model. Thankfully, that is precisely what Christians have in Jesus. When we say with Peter, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God," we confess, In you, Brother Jesus, we see what it means to see clearly. You are the one who recognizes and embodies the clear-sighted truth that each and every person is of infinite worth. Beggars, lepers, tax collectors, Samaritans, Roman centurions, neighbor and enemy alike. Now that's what clear vision looks like. When we call you Messiah, Son of the Living God, we confess that we recognize you as the clearest lens we have to peer into the tender heart of God. In fact, we confess that you are the loving heart of God made flesh, forgiving, touching, embracing, healing, and reconciling. When we say that you are the Messiah, we wager our lives, we make a leap of faith that your way of living, learning, and loving is the most beautiful, tender, and compassionate way we know to live out a human life. From you, we learn that the hallmark and essence of clear vision is love. We learn that only those who love see clearly. Lord, teach us to see clearly and love each other and ourselves as you have done and you would have us do. Amen.